Is what we just spoke about. I'm probably just gonna constantly ask you personal questions, and you're gonna have to kind of weave your way into the book we actually want to talk about. I'm just gonna how's your eye color? How did you get those eye colors and stuff like that? I don't know. Bullshit questions. I have a small, mini introduction. My name is Maarten Hemmen. Some people that listen to the podcast know. A lot of people also know that I've had a long, ongoing, dark period in my life, resulting in one of those very, very darkest days in which I not only thought, but also decided to try and end my life. And from that point on, I started looking forward, and I started with some very classical things that our society kind of offers you when you when you're in that situation. I had psychotherapy and I had hypnosis therapy and a lot of things. And at some point, I actually noticed that my feeling said that I didn't really get that far yet, although I've been having years of therapy. And this is something I told on a big stage recently. There was this one picture on Instagram of someone that I've known for quite a long time, of different times as well. And this guy he not only looked amazing, he had a look in his eyes, like these very deep, deep blue eyes that kind of looked, they could look through a wall, I would say. This man was Casper van der Meulen, and I've known him from earlier days in which we've made music and didn't really care too much about our health, I don't think, psychologically as well as bodily health. And the picture flashed me so much that I asked if we could have a Skype talk, because I wanted to know everything about how Casper came to be. And it was only a picture. That was the most crazy thing, but I knew there was more behind it. Anywho, we had a Skype talk like an hour. You told me, like, with the lightness and easiness you mostly tell things, like very easy, as if everyone can do it. You started this, you did that, then you met Wim Hof, went on a mountain in shorts, and hey, Maarten, why don't you come to Poland and do the same? So in 2017, only like 3 years ago, I went to Poland with a friend of mine. And there was this one moment in which at the very, I think the first, we came in the evening, the first day following, we walked up a small hill. You kind of kindly asked us to take off our clothes and only had our swimming pants on. And you kind of threw us in 1 degree's water with a smile on your face, nothing like it was your everyday routine. And I was in the water for approximately 20 seconds, no more. And it changed my life, and that's pretty, it's pretty crazy. It changed my life to such a degree that very first moment I felt things I haven't been feeling for, I think, 20 years. And there was a connection inside of me, and that was that there's more in life, and like as if a door opened and I came into this completely new room full of possibilities to do stuff. And from that point on, I started working, and that is all irrelevant now. This was just kind of my introduction, because today I speak with Casper van der Meulen, and you are this guy. You changed my life. Ain't that a how do you say, a crazy thing, an honor? I don't know. What is it? What is it?
Well, you changed your life. That's, I didn't do, I just told you to get in the cold water. You did the rest.
Well, I had to get in first. I mean, someone had to tell me.
Well, you know, it's actually a very interesting thing that I've been studying within myself a lot, this question of inspiration and life-changing experiences. Because, yeah, I've known many deep, dark days like you have, and I feel like I'm just kind of like stumbling along on this path of life. But I've been very grateful and very humbled for the fact that I was able to find a mode of expression, which is teaching, that allows me to convey the things that I learn from my own kind of struggles in a way that serves people. That's my life's work, and I've just stumbled into that work because I never meant to be a teacher. And it's been extremely rewarding, but it's also puzzling because it's such a weird thing for me still. It's completely surreal to say this even, but there's quite a few people who attribute a life-changing moment to my work. And I always sit with that and I go like, what does that mean? You know, what is really going on in a moment like that, in a moment of life change where things open up? And luckily, I always come to the conclusion that it's not about me. I am not the Messiah. That's very good news. But yeah, it's about creating an environment within which these things happen. And then, even if you do create the environment in which things are allowed to happen and kind of create the space and hold the space, the success of that stands or falls with the willingness for whoever is in that environment to actually do the work. And the hard work, like everybody has work to do, And for some people, it's dealing with depression. For other people, it's dealing with their finances or getting their body in shape, or like any everybody has, or like deep healing work of past life trauma, whatever it is, you know, everybody has work to do. And I think that none of the entire personal development or spiritual like industry scene that exists right now is worth anything if people don't make their personal conscious choice to pick up their work and to start doing it. And it's in one way it's a very noble and glorious and brave path, and at the same time it's a mess. Everybody has their own mess, and it's beautiful.
That's true. That's nice to hear. Those messages are actually, I mean, you also spread what I like very much about your Instagram feed, for instance, is that you spread a lot of these messages and those sides of you too, starting a lot of posts with saying, guys, who am I to, you know, or don't believe everything I say, or the way you feel. I think it's a welcome fresh breeze in this world of ongoing perfection and stuff like this, especially in the field you're in, because in the end, there is a lot about optimizing, getting better at things, getting better at life somehow, right? Maybe for people here in Germany that don't know too much about you, how did you get there? I mean, who are you? Where do you come from? Why stumbling upon life and trying to make it better and helping other people?
I'm from the Netherlands. I once tried to be a musician. It's funny actually that we come from the same village, I would almost say, from the same city. We actually competed in the same basketball league when we were like 12, which you've forgotten, and I still very much remember it. Yeah, you totally like,
and again,
kicked over. I forgot again.
I forgot again.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, well, when I was like 12, yeah. I won national championship and I was like the MVP. And then after that, I got injured because that was the first time that, like, in basketball, I learned about work ethic and I learned about like putting in the work, because I was the least talented kid in any sport in my school. So I had to put like 20 hours of practice to anything I wanted to learn towards all the, and I was a chubby kid and I couldn't fucking jump or walk or whatever. And I learned about work ethic, and then also I learned to work myself to death into destruction. So after we won national championship when I was like 12, and then I started getting injured, but I kept wanting to play, and I ended up in a bit of a lower ranked team. And then we just started losing everything, and I was used to winning, and I was addicted to winning. And I remember that the match actually we played against your team was the last match that I played, because we got our asses kicked so hard and I couldn't deal with it. And I remember you had such a like grin on your face of like kicking our ass, and I was like, what the fuck? So it's funny. It's a funny memory. And
jeez.
Yeah, man, it's interesting. And I've actually, like, this is a fun place to start, because I've had a few things in my life that I was good at by working very hard. And then I used to have these moments of identifying with the results of that, whether it's basketball or music or writing or like speaking, what I do now. And as soon as I started to identify with it, the fun would kind of like dissolve, and it was just work. Identification with your positive traits is just as kind of dangerous as with your negative traits. And a lot of people identify with their negative self-image, which I also used to do. But then you're starting to play a game of identification between the polarities, which means identification with positive traits is also not the best thing. Anyway, yeah, so I after that phase of basketball was like my first love, so to say, that really helped me live a better life. Because before I started playing basketball, I didn't make any friends. I had a really hard time in school. I couldn't really focus. And then as I started to, yeah, like hone my skills, and suddenly I had role models to look up to, you know, I'm of course the Michael Jordan generation, Space Jam, and, you know, Kobe Bryant's rookie year, rest in peace. And, you know, it's that gave me something to kind of live for. Because as a kid, I had a lot of mental struggles. I had like some diagnosis and like an anxiety disorder, and one thing that always happened, whatever went wrong, is that my mother would always help me kind of disentangle what those things meant and what to do about it. So, for example, when I was in a very bad state as a kid, she would take me to a doctor, and the doctor was like, "Oh, that's panic disorder. We can give him this medication." And she was like, "Thank you for your opinion." And then we went to, you know, another type of therapist, or to like a holistic practitioner, and to a kinesiologist, and just gather all this information. And then she sat me down, and she was like, "Okay, so this person says this. I don't think that's a good idea to take this route. And that person says that. I think there's some good in there." And we came up with kind of like, all right, so out of all these experts, and my mother was a nurse, and my own personal opinion, and my grandfather was a doctor, actually, one of the first doctors in the Netherlands who started to integrate herbal medicine into his standard practice, because he didn't see the difference between herbal medicine and like pharmaceutical medicine. He was just like, well, whatever works, which was very innovative at the time, like in the 60s. And my mother was like, okay, so here's what we'll do. It'll be hard, but you'll stop eating sugar, stop having dairy and a few other things, and then we'll just see if it helps. And then, well, what do you know, two months later, I was suddenly getting better grades, and I was feeling better. And I had less of my dark thoughts that kept me up at night, and I slept well, and I started making friends. And, you know, I got into basketball. I started doing sports. So very early on in life, this whole concept of the paradigm, like the life view of realizing that our states of being are linked to our own behavior. That's something that came to me pretty early in life in that way. And that doesn't mean that I then learned how to be awesome and stayed awesome. Of course, many ups and downs. Because then when I got injured with basketball and everything, then I got into another very dark period where all I did was just get high all day and get into trouble, and then stopped going to school, and had a very, very difficult phase in my life where also I stopped doing all the things of which I knew that worked. And so I knew that if I don't eat sugar, I have far less depressive thoughts. I knew that if I don't eat sugar or dairy, I can focus. I don't have my ADD type of symptoms. And in that time, that was a very like forward thought. There was no doctors or psychologists agreeing with that. Like, people were telling my mom she was like crazy for not giving me the medication and just changing my diet. So that's something that I learned early on. And at the same time, I learned how difficult it is that if you know the solution, to actually keep it and to stick to it, you know, and to actually make that choice on a daily basis, even though you know I'm about to eat this whatever thing that's bad for me, and 2 hours from now, I'm going to feel really bad. Still, it is near impossible to do it. And this is something that has fascinated me just endlessly, because I used to, and especially like after in that kind of dark period, I met so many amazing people, just good, wonderful, awesome people that were good friends of mine. And they were seeing their lives being destroyed by drugs. And it was like they weren't even doing it. It was like the drugs were doing it. And they said it, like people, they started doing hard drugs and all this stuff. And I kind of got out of it, out of the kind of like bad boy game around that time. And I was like, but you can see that your life is being destroyed, and that you're like, that you're going, that everything is going downhill, and you're not functioning as well. Like, why do you keep doing it? So it was all so fascinating to me. And of course, I had the same thing. I was still overweight, and I still smoked, and so yeah, that's really a path that I've kind of been on my whole life, of figuring out how do I improve my state out of a necessity, and at the same time, why is it so difficult to do the things that are good for us? So anyway, yeah, and then I started working as a biology teacher, which again was not something of my choice. It kind of like randomly happened. I wanted to study biology because I wanted to figure out how the human system functions at a biological level. That was kind of the thing I was most interested in. And I was a very environmentalist type of person. I was like, I'm going to figure out how my brain works, fix it, and then save the whales and the trees. That was kind of my plan. And then if all else fails, I can always...
Whatever happened to that?
Well, I'm on it. I'm working on it, man. One thing at a time. Yeah, because that's really funny. Because I thought like I need to go out there and save whales and save the trees and save the rainforest. And actually, this is another funny thing. When I was like 18, I was like, I told my mom, I'm gonna go to Africa. I'm just gonna help. I'm gonna do stuff. I'm gonna save the fucking trees. I'm gonna like, help people. And she's like, but
so recognizable.
Like, what are you gonna do there? And I was like, I'm just going to help. She was like, with what? You can't do anything. And I was like, what do you mean? She was like, you have no skills. I was like, ow, what are you saying?
Brutally honest.
Yeah, though. And my mom did that thing. When she was 18, she went to South Africa and she went to help. So I was like, you did that? And she was like, yeah, I was a nurse. I was saving lives every day. What do you got, bitch? Well, she didn't say that, but that's kind of how I felt it, you know? And I was like, oh man, yeah, that's kind of correct. And I can't even make my own bed. I can't even go a day without a cigarette. And I think I can go there and save a tree, you know, and like save a whale, whatever. Well, you know, I'm not going to save a whale in Central Africa. But the point is that they're not there. They're going to go to the South Pole and save the polar bears. Anyway, so yeah, it was trippy. And then in order to get my to be able to study biology, I had to go do a teacher's degree because I wasn't able to go to university right away. It's how the Dutch school system works.
Yep.
And I had to do a teacher internship, and I didn't want to be a teacher, and I really was against education as a institute. I still am in some way, so I didn't take it seriously at all. And it just worked. I just found a flow and I just had fun. And the fact that I didn't take it seriously allowed me to figure out new ways of teaching that were innovative and that worked really well for me, and that kind of took off. So I really found that the positive influence I always have wanted to have on the world, I could have that in my classroom in that moment. And I didn't have to spend 6 years studying in order to go do some science on how to save a whale. I can just be here and talk to these kids about at first, at you know, about just nature and the importance of nature, because I was a biology teacher, so I was like, can talk about these things. And then I started to realize we can talk about our own biology and figure that out. So we just started to do little experiments and learn about how the brain works and how we can improve our learning and how we can make learning fun. And I found that there was all this good science on how the brain works and how we can kind of optimize our ability to learn. And I was like, why aren't we using that? Like, there's all kinds of teachers doing all kinds of things every day across like thousands of schools with millions of kids, and these things don't make a lot of sense. They don't work really well, and they don't match up with what science already knows about how to learn. What's going on? That's weird. So I started kind of experimenting, and that's when I really I started kind of like hacking my classroom and experimenting on my students. It was a lot of fun. And at the same time, I was still like 35 kilos too heavy. I still smoked. I was very fast on the way to my first burnout. I did the same thing with basketball. I took it too seriously. Got perfectionist, you know, and these kids were looking up to me, and I was like, why do they look up to me? I'm a bad person. They don't even know. I got kind of depressed. I got into a very dark period. And then I realized, like, wow, these kids are looking up to me and I'm a mess. And maybe if before I can, because at first I was like, I'm going to save the whole world, the whole environment. Then I was like, oh, I'm going to save the whole school system. And then I was like, I can't even save myself from my own like slow suicide of smoking, for example. You know, what am I even doing? Let me just focus on myself. So I really went, and that's a really cool question. What happened to the environmentalism? Well, it's still there, but I also realized that nobody's going to take care of their environment externally if their internal environment is a mess. So then I started to focus on my internal environment, my thoughts. I learned to meditate. I learned self-hypnosis. I started getting into breathing techniques. And then, I came to a point where I was like, oh, I have some really cool things that I've learned. There's a lot of stuff out there. And I just want to put that in a format where people can very simply take it on. And I want to write it at a level where my students could read it, but also, well-read, educated people can read it and still get something out of it and apply these things. And that then turned into the book, Mindlift, which is now aptly titled Mentale Fitness für das perfekte Mindset.
I was kind of just like, because I know you, I thought, you know what, he probably wrote it himself in German too, because that's the kind of the Casper way. Like, okay, give me 2 weeks to learn German. I'll write the book in German. It just came out in German now. So it's out in Dutch, English, German.
Yeah. And we're talking actually to a French publisher. And
crazy. And indeed,
it's a funny story actually, because I was going to speak at Flowfest this year.
Yeah.
Which is a great, great conference, biohacking conference. And I was talking to the organizers and I was like, so my book is coming out in German. How about I take like 3 months to speed learn German, and then I do my keynote in German, and then I have my German book, and I have a German girlfriend, so I've moved into the German market in many ways, and then like of course, well, you know, the event got canceled, yeah. and I realized how much work it would be to be fluent in that language, and
well, you do have to know one thing that might spark the idea. Or fire it back up, or I don't even know if it's still there. The good thing is, out of my own experience, because I mean, most Germans know it especially by my spelling mistakes. I'm Dutch too. Germans love Dutch people speaking German, especially if it's not too good. That's because they immediately feel like they're on vacation, because they only know Holland from vacation, and I would encourage you to do it, because probably, I mean, half of the people's only going to be not listening to your messages anymore, but, you know, it'll still work.
Yeah, I was actually considering to record the audiobook myself.
Oh, yeah.
Because then I actually read my own German book, and it's good practice.
Yeah.
And I can kind of like, you know, order a beer and ask for the way in German right now. I mean, it's kind of like a language has been around.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if that's a good idea, but this is a good argument.
I definitely do it. Yep, do it, and don't make it too. I mean, really, just like you, you just told the title. That's enough. That's a German you need. Mentale Fitness für das perfekte Mind. You also need to. That's what Dutch. Now I live here. Realize Dutch kind of also change their voice when they speak German into this slightly lower army officer voice thing.
Well, yeah, there's two options. They go down an octave and sound very strict,
or
because
who,
they watch too
do
many
we go
war
to,
movies.
Kasper?
Or they what?
Or who do we go to? Who's what's the?
Well, and then there's another one where they go higher to the more modern, and they go, yeah.
No, but I mean, you've got one more favorite though that we definitely need to.
Oh yeah,
incorporate
no, that's
once.
Not German. That's Austrian.
He's Austrian,
that's,
huh?
That's the Arnold. Yeah.
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 I mean,
you know what's funny actually, that I've had so many like I've tried to. There was this phase where I was really about the Arnold, and every time I would say "get down," I'd be like, "Ah, get down," and get to the chopper. And you were in that phase. I was in a very heavy Arnold phase, because I had just finished listening to the Arnold Schwarzenegger autobiography, and the first part is in his voice. And I'm just a voice nerd, like a language nerd. I love it. And when I started teaching internationally, I would have groups. And there would be groups from all over Europe and all over the world, actually, with everybody their own accents. And I love that. Like I've always done weird accents, and I've always enjoyed it. So I used to kind of like take that opportunity to learn people's accents, to learn how to do like a Scottish accent or you know, whatever, an Italian accent. And I really enjoy it. And if I introduce it well, people like it. But I've also found myself in situations where people get offended because they feel like I'm making fun of them, or they're like, oh, that's racist. And the funny thing is, if you're in a group with Europeans and we're doing each other's accents and kind of like making stereotypical Europe jokes, then the Germans love it. I mean, the Europeans love it, and the Americans go like, isn't that offending? Isn't that racist? And it's kind of like a weird thing. So anyway, but Arnold is easy game. Like, that's one that you can always do. You can always, yeah. get the pump in the bicep. Yeah, I love that.
I mean, you could do a B version of your book in Arnold's.
And then, yeah, but then the English, oh, that's actually a good idea.
Yeah, and then do one in Homer Simpson, and then, I mean, we got it all.
Wow.
Yep.
That's the dream.
Back to this book, because everything, you said one very interesting thing that also, I've actually read your book in Dutch already quite a long time ago. I think, I don't know when, I think I ordered your Dutch book, like, could it be 2 years ago already? Is it already that?
Could be, yeah, it's been out for 4 years.
Yeah.
Five.
Damn. Well, then I reread the German version, which is always cool because there's things you read in different situations. And so there's also different comprehending, I always feel, you know, in things that are in the book. I've read it totally different 2 years ago than in my state now.
Well, and that's true. But also, to be fair, this is a translation from English. So I did Dutch first, and then I did English, which was a pretty big update, improvement. And then that was translated to German. But that's true. That's one thing I really love about understanding multiple languages, is that you get to apply a different vocabulary to the same topic content. And it's almost like you're taking a different technology to it. And even now with, because, you know, I'm Dutch and my girlfriend is German, but we speak English together and she's learning Dutch because she's living here now. And I'm learning German much more slowly because there's no necessity. But a lot of times we have like a concept and then we translate it in both languages, and it gives you a much broader scope of understanding the subject. It's really magnificent how you can switch to another vocabulary and have a different point of view, or even feel differently. I mean, I don't know if it's with you, but I've spoken to a lot of multilingual people who say, I have slightly different personalities in different languages. Okay. Yeah. I like myself better in English. Yeah. Funny enough.
Yeah. True. I don't know if this is film and the whole business induced, but I kind of also feel a tad more professional in English, actually, than in both of the other languages. But somehow, because I mean, especially in the field we're in, and for instance, with breathing, there's so much cool stuff coming out currently, which is in English and has English titles to them. I mean, it's also the German language is for instance, over breathing or terms like that. They just don't sound that sexy in German too. That's the only problem we need to work on.
Breathing. Here. Breathing is a nice breathing. Word. Atmung is
a
bit.
Atmung. Yeah. Atmung. Breathing. It sounds like you're breathing.
True.
Here we go again. Back to the book. So your book, because I do sincerely want people to read this, especially in Germany, because what I really like about this book, and what, for instance, you said earlier, is it focuses very much on how to use your brain, how to learn, how to change your behavior, and especially which focus you have on yourself. You just said earlier, and there was a part that I reread that I really related to, is that if you only judge yourself or are judged by your talent and by everything that went well and all those kind of things, instead of being focusing on the process of things, it's a very destructive way to become better or to live your life, maybe even, like, you know, there's a part in which you say that being always rewarded by your parents for your talents, for your natural abilities especially, will make you very bad at failing at a test, because you will immediately see your whole personality being taken apart by something that's only a process. And I just reread that, and it blew my mind because I had it in such a different light. I'm not really sure what I want to say with this. I just want to say that in general, the book, for all the people who are kind of maybe stuck or not even stuck or looking for ways to really, really, really find new input into how you can change your daily life by several or thousands, yeah, it feels, of mini steps.
Well, I mean, that's definitely true. And I feel like if I read the book now, I feel like I would want to update it and it would double in size. But at the same time, at the core level, that thing you just mentioned is really like the main premise of the book, is that we highly underestimate our ability to change and grow and develop, and also the speed at which it is possible. And like, I've never seen myself as very talented. And if people take a snapshot of what I do now, especially now that I've taken all my weird stuff and I just do it at the same time. So I'm teaching breathing, and then I'm playing handpan at the same time. And then like, some people, they see me like count backwards in my non-native language while I'm like playing a complicated handpan rhythm, and they almost fall off their chair because they think it's so complicated, and they go like, oh, this guy must be super talented. But the funny thing is that it's just practice, you know? I've just spent a lot of time practicing very specific, very nerdy things that didn't seem to have any practical application to life at all, where people would be like, just do something useful. And I've always learned in every direction that just interested me. And then later on, figure out a way to make that applicable and practical, and to present it in a way where it's like cool to look at. Like, for example, making music and guiding breathing at the same time. But it's not about talent at all. It's just putting in work. And like I said in the beginning, for example, basketball. I mean, I may have been talented. Could be. When I started, I was far behind on everybody else. And then, you know, I did a lot of work. And then I started to get ahead of other people. In that scenario, it didn't matter whether I was talented or not, because I had to put in the work anyway. Because either you put in the work to actually, if you look at your talent as like a raw diamond, you need to put in a lot of work to make it shiny, right? And if you don't have talent, it's like a bit more of a boring rock. But if you polish the boring rock, it could still end up looking better than the raw diamond, you know? And I'm not sure if that's the best example. But anyway, let's roll with it.
It's a nice analogy. I
wrote about this brain researcher called Carol Dweck, and she talks about it like it's a little rubber bands. Yeah. And people with a lot of talent. So let's say somebody is a piano prodigy, and their raw talent for playing the piano. I mean, your genes don't know what a piano is, right? So it's musical talent that just happens. The best expression of that may be the piano, and then that talent is basically a very long rubber band, so it's a high capacity. And then if that would be stretched, it could be very large. And then if you have low talent, you have a very small rubber band for that particular capacity. But if you do a lot of practice, you will end up with potentially, so somebody who doesn't practice with a lot of talent has less ability to play the piano well than somebody with less talent who practices a lot, because they have eventually a higher, more stretched rubber band. And talent really only plays the biggest role in the top 5% of performance. All right. So for example, I could actually try to be Arnold and be like, I get the pump in the bicep, eat all the protein, and do that every day for the rest of my life and do exactly the amount of work that Arnold put in, and start just as early on in life and all that stuff. And most likely, I will not look as good as him on stage. I will not win. That's why he is seen as the greatest, because there were many people who worked as hard as him who didn't eventually look that good. So in the top fields of performance, like the top 1 to 5%, talent makes the difference. That is the big game changer in fields like the Olympics and stuff like that. But for just everyday normal humans who just want to live good lives, talent is not an interesting thing to think about. Whether you like, should I play music? Well, no, I should not, because I'm not talented. That's ridiculous, you know. If you enjoy it, you do it, you practice, you get better, because the real joy in anything is evolution, is growth. Like the constant loop of improving yourself and having like a win gives you a little bit of a dopamine hit, gives you a reward, and the joy of growing towards a direction that is interesting to you is the biggest thing. And even if you look at the best, for example, AIs that are now being built, the ones that have a program built in that where they're looking at making mistakes as much as they can and improving based on those mistakes and incrementally getting better, those artificial intelligence programs run far better than the ones that use data. Right. So, for example, if you have a chess machine that knows all the rules about chess, and this is a very epic battle that was done in the world of chess machines. So you have the best chess machine in the world. I forgot its name because it has a name. And it knows all the rules. It has run every single possible program that was ever documented. So it has played the course of every game ever, and it has access to all of the data about chess ever in the world. Like, and that's the best chess AI that was ever built. So it has all the information, it has all the advantage. And that was pitched against AlphaZero, which was made by Google. And this is a reinforcement learning program, which didn't know chess at all. It had never played chess at the beginning of the standoff to the best chess computer ever. But what it had, the main thing that it had, and I'm not an AI expert, but the main thing that it had built in is that it was a learning program, and it didn't need to have any data built in about chess because it was built to learn anything and to make thousands of tries and mistakes and to have every time that there's a win to build onto that win. So that within like, I don't know, like a ridiculous, I always forget the numbers on this, but within like a few hours, it learned chess so effectively that it could beat the best chess computer in the world with all of the data about chess ever in no time and like by a landslide. And that's the type of stuff that inspires me, because I've always felt like I'm behind on everybody else. Like I was not as good at anything as the other kids in my class. Sports, whatever, calculus or language, or the only thing I was slightly better at was biology, because I was always a nerd for like learning about plants and nature. But talent wise, I was behind. And funnily enough, also on the talent, this last thing I'll say about the talent thing, my parents were like, Casper needs to do something useful instead of sitting inside playing video games. When I was like, whatever, I don't know, 10 or 9 maybe. So, okay, music is good for him. Let's take him to music class. And then I went to, the first thing was like a choir singing group. And after a few practice sessions, the teacher went to my parents and he was like, do you think he maybe enjoys something else? Maybe like sports? Because he doesn't really seem to have the talent for this. And then I'm like, oh, okay, all right. And then I went to basketball practice. And after a few basketball practices, they were like, does Casper maybe enjoy anything else? Maybe like music?
Choir singing.
So the first professional that I met in both music and sports told me that I didn't have any talent. And they said, do something else. And then, you know, 3 years later, I was national champion basketball. And then 6 years later, I was a professional musician teaching music to kids, you know. And I was like, oh, maybe they didn't see my talent, or maybe the whole question of talent is just bullshit and I just put in the work because I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is. You just, I wanted to ask, is talent bullshit? It's not. I mean, you said the highest, let's say 5%, it might make a difference, but
I mean, talent is amazing. I'm just saying it shouldn't be. It's not the determining factor for whether or not you should do something.
Yeah.
All right. So the whole question, the way that we approach talent, focusing on talent, is that's just not the... And even in education, like if you have a child and they're talented at a certain thing, like for example, my daughter, she seems to have a tendency towards language. Her language is ahead of the curve and she's speaking well and she's learning English. Then if you're like, oh, that's her talent, she should focus 100% on her talents, then... Wouldn't that be kind of like a limited way to learn? Like, I'd rather have her just enjoy whatever she wants to enjoy instead of creating a direction on her based on the idea that she may have talent in that direction. No, it's nice to just learn in all directions. And especially those rubber bands that need more stretching, focus on that. At least that's my view of things. To be kind of like a well-rounded human, you just want to explore all these different sides.
Yeah. And focus on learning itself, the process. I mean, that's where we're back. Kind of, that's what the circle is around. The statement you have in this book, like focus on the full process of repeatedly doing things and sometimes succeeding, sometimes failing, but always just kind of tuning the process, to get somewhere or to have a new skill. And I think that it's pretty amazing that even now by this time, I mean, I've had so many different talks about learning and school systems and everything. And I mean, your approach, your complete book could be a guide for how to build up new forms of schools, you could even say. But I've been having these kind of talks since like 4 or 5 years intensively with people, and the change should have maybe already been, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago. It's pretty crazy that schools still kind of are the way they are exactly, although the science has already, you know, I think, I don't know if it's in your book or if you just said it, that's the contradictio in termini, how do you say it? It's like, you know, it doesn't, the way we teach science in schools and what we've learned from science, that teaching science the way we teach science in schools is bullshit. Yeah. This kind of, this whole construct is already, is the weirdest thing ever.
But that also, I mean, it comes down to a much bigger question on a much bigger level. And that is, does the current school system have our individual advancement of truth and understanding and self-development, so our actualization, as the highest goal? Well, no, it does not. Like, self-actualization is not the goal of education. The goal of education is to produce people who have a standard set of qualities and information so that they can kind of predictably function within the society that we have. Now, and the reason that that is not really working anymore is because that idea, it has become kind of flawed. So the kind of like the school system, the idea that as long as, so we need a population where as many people as possible understand and know the same things and think in the same way, because then we can have that kind of like engine. The engine of the country is the humans in the country, and we need them all at the same level so we can kind of like produce the right amounts of living standards for everybody in the country. And that was, of course, the main mission of every country 100 years ago, when we didn't have, you know, civilization and technology at the point where we needed it to be. So 100 years ago, the whole idea of just sit down, shut up, you're lucky to even be here. Like, you could be working, like your grandfather was working in the field when he was 12. Just be happy that you're inside and you're dry and you're actually allowed to be here. So shut up and do what I say. You know, that whole idea is like, yeah, because if you don't shut up and do what I say, you won't be able to get that job. You won't have your house, and then you'll be poor and you'll live in the streets. And that is, of course, a premise that was true for our grandfathers and grandmothers and even our parents, because that promise still worked. Just sit down, shut up, do your best. Get your degree, then you can get this job. You can do the job for 40 years, and then you have, hopefully, you still have some health left at the end of your work time, and then you can enjoy your health and your money while it lasts, and then you expire, and then the circle starts over. And of course, that worked. We built great countries based on that paradigm, because for that, you know, historically, that's the thing that worked. And the promise held up. And now it doesn't anymore, because we don't need more bricks in the wall. We don't need more people knowing the same things. Now suddenly we need critical thinkers, and we need people that can judge truth, and that can read sources, and that are literate in their self-learning, that are self actualized, self-directed learners, because we're not dependent on these buildings and books for information. Everybody can learn now, or at least everybody could learn now, except we haven't learned how to learn. And I think that is the core of the kind of change in direction that society needs to make, and that the world needs to make at a large level, from like a bird's eye view, is that for the first time in history, we're living in a period where self-actualization could be the main, let's say the main purpose of everybody's life, and not just privileged people. Like, everybody now lives at a standard where they don't have to worry about being drafted in the army because war may start anytime soon. You know, they don't have to worry about freezing to death in a heavy winter, or dying of this is a bad example right now, but dying of a flu tomorrow. right? But still, it's still true. It's still true. It still holds up. Like medically, security-wise, war-wise, we live in the best time ever. There's infinite information. There's so much wealth. And especially, I think, if you live in a Western country and you're lucky enough to be born in the right place nowadays, you have such a head start towards the rest of history. And now the question is, what do we do with it? Well, what we have done with it so far is we're sick and we're miserable. You know, like 50% of our population, and this goes for all the wealthy Western countries, Germany and the Netherlands and France and everything, gets chronically medicated when they're over 55. And like half of the population is obese, you know, it's chronically inflamed. Has like dopamine issues and cortisol problems and
sleep apnea
and general like sleep and sleep apnea isn't even the biggest problem. It's lack of sleep, like not enough REM sleep. That's very interesting that we live in this amazing, wonderful, luxurious time, and the majority is sick and miserable and depressed and unhappy, and there's only a few people that are brave enough to truly challenge that. Like that's what inspires me a lot about your content, is that it's so raw and so open and so honest. And I think that, and that's also a reason that I always decide to be personal and to tell stories that are real, because that's the only way for us all to stop kind of pretending that we're all fine and just really do the work. Because I think in order to really, really leverage the benefits of this modern world and all the luxuries we have to kind of like go back and set some things straight that need to be fixed. Like, you know, we're all like everything is there. Like we have education, we have hospitals, we have a wealthy government, we have all of it, but still we are the grandchildren of people who went through war, you know, and this is something we can't just pretend that, oh, that's two generations ago, that is gone. No, we still have some healing work to do there. And like we live in a time with the least amount of war and famine ever, but that means we're recovering as humanity, as a human race. And I like to think of consciousness in that like global way. We're recovering from centuries of slavery and war and the most ridiculous, like horrible stuff that went on. Yeah, and we have it good, but if we don't do our inner work, yeah, we still end up living miserable lives.
Don't you feel like, because that's what I mean to see a lot and also work with a lot, is that even though we live in this very, very comfortable time and very, our systems, especially body and reactions, and they don't really know that yet. I always think there's this funny thing. Your book is very much the brain learning mindset states and stuff like that, but you do way more than that. I mean, it only has a small place in your book, but I've actually gotten to know you because you took us on a mountain in the snow, set our asses in an almost frozen lake and said, here you go, deal with it, because this is what your systems actually know, real fear, real input, real impulses and stuff like that. What I wanted to say is that I tend to work with that more and more, telling people, listen, if you get an email, that's this privileged Western cool world, but your system still reacts like it used to react back in the days when there was a tiger standing in front of you. Yeah. And as long as you don't understand and take these steps back really into what we genetically do and feel and how we react, as long as you don't get there, you will never really fully understand why you are so stressed when something like this or that happens.
Yeah, I've in recent years I've been focusing more and more, like, and it's just not because I don't think the mindset perspective is valuable anymore. The mindset perspective, like, I stand behind everything I wrote, but at the same time I'm always learning new things. And now I've been getting one thing that I think is extremely important that people don't really get is that their mental state, the thoughts they have, is like the tip of the iceberg for your physiological state. So when you become aware, consciously aware, of having a conscious thought, there has been like a whole cascade, like a whole set of dominoes that have been ticked over physiologically and emotionally, which is the same thing, Way before that, and way before that, I'm talking about like 3 milliseconds. But it's big in
the system.
That's giant. That's huge. That means that before you become conscious of anything in your life, your physiology has dealt with it. And what does that mean? It means that millions of years of survival programming, so your hormonal systems, the electrical state of your nervous system, all of that is built to deal with every single thing that happens in your life on a subconscious level. So by the time you become conscious of something, it's very interesting to kind of like remind yourself that is only 1-4% of your life is what you become conscious of, which means that 95-99% of everything that goes on in your life is being dealt with by your automatic pilot, by your subconscious, by your autonomic nervous system. And only a few things that it does, it sends a memo up to your brain and goes like, hey, here's the thought about this thing. Here you have some conscious ideas about it, but don't worry. Like, here's just a memo. We've already dealt with it. Like, you're already making adrenaline, you're already making cortisol, you're already like, you're already standing in front of the fridge stuffing your face with chocolate because you felt an emotion you didn't. It's funny, right? Like, there's an emotion you don't want to feel, and then before you know it, you're like smoking or overeating. And then by the time you become, and then your body's like, oh, by the way, something scary happened an hour ago. Now you overate and you drank five beers. Yeah, and so here's a thought about it. Use that to judge yourself. And then you go like, oh, I'm such a bad person. Why can't I get my life in control? Well, because you're not in charge. Like, you have this primal hunter-gatherer body and mind, nervous system that determines how you feel and what you do and how you respond to life. You don't have a lot of say in that. And it's a funny, in one way, it's a weird thing to think about, that we don't have that much free will in that way. But what we do have, that as far as we know, none of our other animal friends in the animal kingdom have, apart from perhaps some aquatic mammals like dolphins and whales. They are far more sentient than we... It's showing that there are more sentient, and actually octopuses tend to have a level of sentience that may be similar. Sorry, this is like a biologist problem that I always go into the animal kingdom. But anyway, the one thing we have as humans, like no other species, is the ability to become conscious of our survival trigger. So for example, a gazelle that sees a lion, when it's grazing, it's grazing. When it sees the lion, it just runs away. Fight, flight, it just goes, boom, or flight in this case. It goes, it escapes, right? And mm-hmm. and that's it. And there's no moment for the gazelle, as far as we know, where it becomes conscious of that, which has upsides and downsides. That also means that the gazelle doesn't have to go find a therapist and be like, and I saw the lion, and I think the lion represents my father when he was trying to disapprove of my life.
You know? I think I kind of look funny when I run, don't you think?
Exactly. Yeah, I ran away from the lion and I survived, but I felt like I looked like a total sissy when I was running. It's like, do I look fat? Is that what a lion is trying to eat me? It's because I'm fat, isn't it?
Woo!
Yeah. But at the same time, the gazelle also doesn't get to ponder over the like magnificent splendor of life in this experience, you know, and it doesn't get to create art from the struggles it has, and it doesn't, you know, so the conscious mind is a great gift, but it can also definitely be something that's very much in the way of us living out our experience in the most kind of expressive and actualized way. So the point is that I think studying the subconscious and the nervous system programming that we have is the most important thing. And that's why I got so obsessed with breath work. Not because I'm necessarily super interested in breathing. It's a funny thing. Like, I always have to come out of the closet and tell people that I'm not actually that interested in breathing. Like, I'm not more interested, like, still, passion-wise, I'm actually more interested in trees and whales and in weird percussion instruments from all over the world, which I have like a vast collection of, way too many shakers, you know. It's like that's like a pure fascination. The reason I became a breathing specialist is, again, kind of reluctantly, but it just works. Like, no matter what I do, every single thing that I've ever tried, it all comes down to breathing. And then if you look at the yogic sciences, the yogic practices that are ancient, that are 5,000 years old, they already understood that if you want to self-actualize and live the highest possible beingness in this human life, you have to transcend some of your purely physical survival stimuli and systems. And in order to do that, you have to start by studying the breath, which is the ultimate link into that subconscious. So that's kind of, yeah, it just works. It always does. And it's funny because, like, for example, people have thoughts and they worry and they think there's a few levels to that. You can worry about something and think it is about the thing. So you have like an idea, like you have a deadline, and you go like, oh, the deadline is my problem. And then if you go you peel one layer or a few layers, you get to like, oh, no, wait, actually my mindset about the deadline is the problem. This is what mind lift is a lot about. And you change your mindset and suddenly you get mind lifted and the problem gets lifted and, you know, the problem is no longer a problem. And then, oh, but what's behind that? And you peel a few more layers and then you realize that your hormonal state, so your biochemical state, is the thing that produces the mindset. So then you go, huh, that's interesting. So apparently I had a cortisol release, and then a layer behind that is maybe your body produced cortisol much faster in relation to the stimuli because, you know, as soon as you see something scary, your body produces energy, it produces CO2, and if you have a low CO2 tolerance, then you have a much higher likelihood of having an anxious thought because you need to go into flight because your body is in physiological danger. Hey, that's interesting. Now I get to work on CO2, and then you get to breathing. And then you peel a layer more, and then you realize that before you even have the biochemical response, you have an electrical response because the electrical system is faster than the hormonal and biochemical system. So even before you have the cortisol, there is a nervous system response that's happening, right? Because you have your actual nerves, your senses, they process the information. And then you get to, you know, understanding your nervous system at a deeper level where you realize like, oh, so I have, there's an impulse coming in, and then I have, you know, an electrical response, because even cortisol is triggered by the adrenal glands, but it's kind of like the assignment for that is done by the hypothalamus, which has an electrical wire towards the adrenal gland. So anyway, and then there's layers and layers and layers. The point is that now we're suddenly talking about CO2 and about electrical potentialities in your nerves. And then you go like, but wait, wasn't there this deadline that I was worried about? No, apparently not. Apparently you had a physiological state that was producing a certain quality of mindset. And from the lower quality of mindset, you weren't able to see that challenge as an opportunity or as a positive or as a fun challenge or as an opportunity for growth. You're seeing it as perceiving it as danger, but that is because you were in a physiological state of unsafety by, for example, raising CO2 and not having the ability to have CO2, or the body feels like it doesn't have enough oxygen to deal with a situation. So that's like that's the most interesting thing to me. It's like dissecting the human experience from the outside world, the things we perceive and that happen to us, and then the way we mentally think about them, to the state of our body that produces the thinking to see the whole thing. And then we get really like in the wiring, but I love that. And at the core, it's a very simple process, and you can just find infinite layers of that.
Boom. It is.
Was that too much?
No. This is superb. This is, that's, actually, you have a small part in your book where you speak about the moment between stimulus and reaction, kind of. And I think the book The Wedge from Scott Carney, I think, yeah, is a lot about that. It's a lot about this moment or recognizing, especially physiologically, what is happening and somehow how to deal with it. What I think is very cool about breathing as well, and I think I'm a little more fascinated by it. I do really enjoy, or it's not like you don't enjoy it, but this breathwork thing kind of got me Anyhow, it doesn't matter. It makes it sound like you're not interested at all, but you just said it's not your favorite thing. You still want to save whales and animals, which, I mean, I want to walk around the world once rather than only do breathing. So maybe it's not my favorite
thing. No. I mean, like, it's not like people think that they go like, where did you find your passion for breathing?
Mm.
And I can't really find it, but I've just always, like, the reason I got obsessed with it, that's true, because it works, you know? But I'm just saying that I wasn't interested. Like, for example, I was passionate about basketball. I was like, everything that had to do with basketball, I had to know it because there was no reason. But for breathing, there was always a reason because it just worked. Like everything I study, I get super excited about nutrition and I go into nutrition and I peel all the layers and I figure it out and I go like, now nutrition, it's all about what you take in. And then you come all the way to the core of nutrition. And what does it come down to?
Breathing.
Metabolism at a mitochondrial level, which is dependent on breathing, and proper function of the digestive tract, which is dependent on the activation of your vagus nerve, which is linked to your breath rate. And boom, breathing is there again. It's just amazing. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, what I'm more trying to say is that I am actually, like, I'm a generalist and I'm interested in every single thing in the world. Like, I'm like anything. Just, I can get it's also interesting to me. And I just want to learn. I want to learn and I want to infinitely learn. And over the years, people start introducing me as a breathing specialist. And I'm like, well, I'm just kind of more like a general biohacker. I think everything is interesting. But it just so happens that I have the most experience in breathing because I read all the science and I did like breathing sessions with thousands of people. And they're like, yeah, so you're a breathing specialist. Here's Casper, the breathing specialist. I'm like, okay.
All right.
It's just like a funny thing, and I don't have anything against it. It's just like a funny thing to me that every single time I do breathing and I realize all of my best work, the most life-changing, most profound work that I do with people all has to do with breathing. And every single time afterwards, I'm like, huh, there it is again. There's breathing again. And so it's funny. It's more like I feel like there's certain things that I went out to go and do. So when I was playing basketball, I was like, I'm going to be the best basketball player in the world. That's my goal. I'm going to be like the best percussionist I could ever possibly be when I got into music. And I didn't have that with breathing, which is nice, which has allowed me to be far more open about it and has allowed me to find, it's the thing that I've excelled in most in teaching breath work because I didn't identify with it and I didn't mean to get anywhere with it, which was the same thing with teaching.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's still, I mean, I study, like, I read about breathing, like, this is one of my favorite books, The Psychology and Physiology of Breathing, and it's, like, ridiculously technical. Like, you have to, it's almost, like, this is not a book you read for fun. Like, normal people don't read this for fun. This is, like big words and science and graphs and tables, and I'm just like, yes, give it to me. It's such a good book. So, it's more like, yeah, it's a fascination. But I just don't want to pin myself down as a specialist in anything because, like, I am now this fascinated in breathing, but I may, like, pick up a super spiritual book or learn about religion or about vegetable fermentation tomorrow and, like, do something different or knitting or whatever.
Knitting. Well, I mean, we'll probably find that at the center of knitting, a good knitting patch is probably breathing as well. That's just a problem. We're going to get back to that all 100%. The time. Well, yeah. I think what especially is also what I really like about breathing is that if you there's some theories about people learning or we memorize better when we have an elevated emotion, for instance. And I think that's the cool thing with breathing. It's so easy to trigger these elevated emotions in all ways, neither only positive or negative. It's everything. But it's just I've had so many moments where people seem to open their eyes and look at you like, holy fuck. Like a connection kind of got there because the emotion is very easily elevated and it's so easy to sense, which is something that gets harder and harder in this society where we get more and more numb. And that's, I think that's why it's for me also, it's a super powerful thing besides also general nature things and the cold. And, you know, that first time I was with you in Poland, it was the same kind of trigger, something that is so out of there, out of this world, kind of coming into you like a freight train, and you cannot hide from those feelings that come. And that I think with breathing, it's pretty easy to in a softer way, but get people really into this elevated state in which they suddenly understand.
It's almost like a microdose of that experience, right? And I think that a lot of people attribute major life-changing moments. They attribute their biggest life changes to those moments. So you remember that big moment of transcendence and connection. Yep. But the reason your life actually changed is because you applied the lessons from that moment later on. And there's also people who have a mountaintop experience and they leave the experience on the mountaintop and they go away and they just keep talking about that moment. Oh, remember, I was on the top of whatever, Mount Everest, and it was the best moment of my life. And then I went back home and I was miserable again. And I just thought about my mountaintop experience. You could not have a mountaintop. You could have a mountaintop experience on your meditation cushion in the morning if you decide to connect to it, right? And I think breathing, like what you just said, is very true, that we get disconnected from our body. And in order to, like, that line of communication with our body is carried, and with our emotions, because that body and, emotions live in the body. That line of connection is built through breathing, and especially conscious breathing, which again is the ultimate human superpower. And if you think about what sets humans apart from other species, or even other humans that lived on this planet, who could also consciously breathe, of course, but I mean consciousness, and then consciousness over our physiology, which is breathing, is really the big thing that sets humans apart from anything else on this planet, which is, of course, our greatest talent and also maybe a great downfall in some situations. But it's just a fascinating thing to study. So I think for any big life-changing experience that people have, including, for example, a child being born or losing a loved one, those are like major emotional events, integrating that and processing that into a daily, a more integrated change of life, a structural change, I should say. I think breathing is the tool to do it, because it allows you, like you just said, to connect to those emotions.
Yeah. Wow.
And some deep shit, you know?
Woo! I asked people to ask you some questions. And the best question, and that's the one you can judge, which is the best question. We'll get the book. That's what I thought.
Oh, cool.
So I got a few questions. One we can do, but someone asked, what is a biohacker? Which I thought was kind of funny. It said, biohacker, I don't even know what a biohacker is.
That's a cool question.
It is actually quite an honest and cool question. Like, hey, I could go on Google, but why don't I just ask?
Well, it's a funny one, because also the term biohacker is something that I also kind of reluctantly took on. Like when I got interested in optimizing my life and everything, I realized that this physiological perspective, like understanding the human experience from a biological standpoint, that's what I was doing, because I was already interested in biology. So I was like, if I want to improve my brain, why don't I figure out how the biology of my brain works, like the chemicals and the states and all this stuff. And then I realized that all of the things that I was interested in and that worked for me and the perspective that I was taking, there was a group of people that was doing the same thing, that I connected with, that I could have these nerdy conversations with, and they called themselves biohackers. And I was like, all right, so that'll be my team then. And the cool thing about biohacking is that it's fairly undefined, because there's biohackers who are mainly interested in transcending their humanness through technology. And they feel like transhumanism this transhumanistic form of biohacking is people that go like, yeah, I want to replace my human function and upgrade it with technology, and have chips implanted, and have like all of this monitoring. Like, so that's a group of biohackers. Then there's a group of biohackers who is very focused on measurement, so using technology to do measurements and have very specific quantifications and work on that. My main thing about biohacking is, as I'm more like a nature nerd, but what I like about, if I look at people that are look everything from like a natural perspective, you often end up in like the field of holistic medicine and herbalism, but also, which is very strongly, I don't want to generalize, but there's a field that is much more towards the spiritual that discards the scientific, and there's people who go away to the scientific and technological, which disregard the spiritual. And in biohacking, you find people that they don't care as long as it works, right? It doesn't matter, just anything. So you can find a biohacker that just as easily goes to a crystal energy healer and at the same time applies scientific studies about a specific supplement or like stem cell injections. And so it's like, it's very experimental. So in short, a biohacker is someone who decides to optimize their human experience through the connection of science and spirituality, nature and technology, and at the base of doing that from the foundation of understanding human biology, and then finding ways to interact with our biology to optimize that experience. So that's a very broad term, and everybody gets to define it. And depending on where you are, like for example, people who call themselves biohackers here in the Netherlands are more of the natural holistic type people who just also take a scientific approach. In America, people who call themselves biohackers are people that sleep with all kinds of wire. Generally, like I'm generalizing again, the American scene is much more dictated by supplements and technologies. That's just a funny thing. It's a good question. I ask myself that question regularly. What is a biohacker anyway?
Nice. That's a good question. Okay. Stefan Neuhauser greets from Mannheim. It's not really a question. I don't know. You know Stefan Neuhauser?
No.
Okay. I thought you might know each other. Oh, greetings from Mannheim.
Ja, liebe Grüße zurück zu Mannheim.
Nice. She says, this girl asks a question, which Fähigkeiten, you know the word Fähigkeiten? Let's say skills, because there's a better word for it, but which skills would you teach kids on their way in life? Or maybe we can say, what would be the biggest tool or skill you would teach kids?
I think the core skill of all of this is to learn to observe the experience instead of only being in the experience. I think that's what self-consciousness is. And of course, children have an amazing quality, if you're a small child, to just be in the experience, right? So you fall and you fall. And when you hurt, you hurt. When you cry, you cry. When you laugh, you laugh. When you dance, you dance. That's all. And then later on in life, we develop this self-consciousness in a non-empowering way where you kind of think, oh, I shouldn't hurt. I should do this. I should do that. I should do that. Now, what's in between that, the skill that allows you to kind of like be free from that human condition of always not being in the moment of the experience, is to learn to observe all the other stuff that also happens. So for example, to take a step back, and when you, for example, when you have pain, you can be the pain and struggle with the pain and fight it, or you can try to take a step back and be like, huh, I'm having pain right now. There's pain happening within me. So to have kind of like a distance view. And one thing I learned very early on as a child, I think I was like 8, was to see my mind as like a workbench. And this is actually, I learned this in hypnosis therapy. It was very interesting. And the question was like, what are you feeling right now? And I was like, oh, I'm feeling frustration. And then he said like, oh, and where do you feel the frustration? And I was like, oh, I feel it in my stomach. Okay, so it's not your entire body. No, it's just there. Okay. And is there any space around the frustration? And I was like, yeah, there is actually. Oh, can you increase that space? And I was like, yeah, I can. Could you walk around it? Yeah. Could you increase it? Yeah. And could you decrease it? Yeah. Oh, interesting. So what I learned is that I am not necessarily my experience, but that it changes and it goes up and down. And for adults, there's actually a method called the Sedona method, which is very similar to this. There's also, from the polyvagal perspective, there's a somatic experiencing. And it comes down to the skill of recognizing that the things we experience are not who we are, and that we can kind of like, but then the question is, who are you? This is too big to teach children. But I mean, there is an observer and there is an experience. And for children, and if you look at mindfulness training for children or yoga for children or schools that use meditation or breathing practice for children, it all starts with disconnecting the identification with the experience and the identification with the observing of the experience. And if you can create that little separation, then you can observe whatever happens without necessarily being controlled by it, which helps you improve your choices and which helps you... And this is actually what I'm saying is learn to meditate. But it's really about that observing.
Yeah. Step back, observing. Nice. Do you remember the most... Oh, in my opinion, maybe the most funny Sedona session that has ever been. It was one in Poland. Because we did it the fourth or fifth evening with Joris.
Mm.
And I was there with Casper, with Jacob. Similar names. Jacob and I don't know, you probably still remember Jacob. Jacob is a pretty sturdy, easygoing, pretty centered. Like, there's not much that brings Jacob out of his...
I remember now. I remember where you're going with this, yeah.
And this is a story I love to tell, because we were doing the Sedona thing and I was going pretty deep in this and playing with this feeling, and it kind of hurt inside and everything, and then after that we just...
People were like crying and releasing trauma.
We sat in a circle and everything, and then Jacob came to speak, and he's like, and it's I think it's extremely funny. He was like, yeah, I was pretty hungry. And then I just let go of it, and now it's okay. I'm not too hungry anymore. And the rest of the circle was going... I was going through childhood trauma and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And Jacob came with his hunger, and it's typical Jacob, because it seriously probably was the only thing bothering him at that very moment.
Yeah. No, but I think to get back to the question, I think that's a very important thing, is to be able to have that distance from whatever you're experiencing allows you to also see a lot of lightness and to see a lot of play. And one thing that we lose very early in life is the ability to just play and to just experience, because we hold on to things that we think are important. So that whole grabbing on to an experience and being like, oh, I must not feel this and I must feel that. If you can have that distance and look at it, then sometimes it's something very intense and heavy that you're feeling, and sometimes it's something funny, I was hungry and I'm a bit less hungry.
It's easy. It was nice. It was a welcome point of view too. Like, that's it could also be light sometimes.
Yeah, for sure.
It's cool. I like playing. Light playing. Okay, I got one more. I think one more question. Those were two questions, but we can get them together, I think. Someone asked, where do you start when you notice that you want to change something? And how do I prioritize when I kind of have like lots of aspirations and I can't choose and I can't, but I really feel I would like to change something in my life?
Yeah, I think we always, like, in a way, the greater the struggle, the greater the triumph. And there's work to be done, and there's great things to do, and there's always really big things that we want to achieve, and then we have to feel like we have to do the whole big thing. But in order to do the whole big thing, like in order to climb an entire mountain, you still have to do all the steps in between. And what Mindlift is really focused on is finding the most fun and the most, so the low-hanging fruit. That's basically what it's about. What is the low-hanging fruit in your life? You know, you may have many goals that are really big and that you really feel like you should achieve, but those are also the things that you probably have the biggest hang-ups about, oh, I should do it, and if I don't do it well enough, it won't be good enough, and it'll be wasted time, and then you have this analysis paralysis where you never get started. So the question is, what is the most fun and what is the easiest thing that still moves you in the direction of where you want to go? So anything that moves you in a direction where you would like to go is good. It's better than not doing a thing that moves you in the direction, or, and even better than doing something that is in the opposite direction of where you want to go. So as long as you're in the right direction, just pick the most fun, simple thing. That's the whole deal. Because then you keep it light and you keep it easy, and you want to have tiny, small wins every day. One example of that is like, people want to, they're like, oh, I want to be super consistent, and I want to be able to, like, I want to change my diet. I want to eat all of these different things. I want to go to the gym 4 times a week. I want to like meditate every day. And that sounds like 3 things, but it's actually hundreds of different decisions you have to make in a day. But then you come down to, what do you really want to learn? What is the mental muscle that you really want to develop? The mental muscle that you want to develop is, I decide that I want to do something, and then I also do it. Like all of the things that I just said, the diet, the meditation, the movement, it is all about, I make a conscious choice for myself and then I follow through. So what is the tiniest version of that? And one example, this is actually an example I think that Joris gave me also, is you take a matchbox, or it's from a Zen book principle, I'm not sure. You take a matchbox, you put the matchbox by the side of your bed, and then in the morning you take one match out of the box, and in the evening you put one match back into the box, and you do that for 30 days. And it's so stupid that it almost seems ridiculous to not be able to, like, how could anybody not do that? Like, how could you fail at taking out a matchbox and putting it back in? So there's no high stakes, right? But it does train the mental muscle of, oh, I decided to do something, and this is so simple and easy, and it's so ridiculous, I might as well just do the matchbox thing, you know? And it's like the tiniest version of what you can do. And even if I work with like nurses who work in like home care, and the person they're guiding is supposed to clean their toilet, but they never do. And every time they go like, oh, clean the toilet, and they never do it. And then they go, oh, I have to have a discussion about it. You're supposed to clean your own toilet. And every time, like for these people, cleaning the toilet is that big mountain. So I'm like, yeah. Do you think this person could maybe clean one tile? It's like, yes, but that doesn't make any sense. I'm like, why not? Just have them do one tile and you come in and you like go like, this is the most awesome clean tile in the world. Like, wow. And after they get really good at cleaning the one tile in their bathroom, they're like, well, next month we do 2 tiles. I'm like, oh, wow, I think I can do that. And then before you know it, they're doing 10 and they feel like they're winning on all sides. And I think we should treat ourselves with that kind of, like, you're training a puppy. You're training the puppy of your subconscious. So you better make it like a really fun and rewarding game. Otherwise, the puppy is going to learn that working on yourself is not fun and easy, and it's not going to want to do it, right? So I think the most fun thing that there is, and my mother simplifies it even more, like when I get stuck, and I always call my mom, and I don't know what to do anymore. Like, what should I do first? Too many things I want to do. And then she just goes like, look at your left hand. And I just look at my, what is the closest thing to my left hand? And it's like, oh, it's like this right now, it's the junk on my desk. And she'd be like, well, then of course you clean the junk on your desk first. How are you going to think without a clean desk? And I'm like, all right, just do the thing that is closest to your left hand. That's like a life rule. And I go, all right, I'll do that. And it's helped me so much. Cause I think that it's about starting, right? The difference between 0 and 1. So the difference between not flowing and flowing, even if it's the tiniest bit of flow, is the big difference. Because the thing you do is the thing you get more of. So once you get going, you'll keep going. That's a very long answer. Just start with something fun and simple.
Well, it is the answer that that's in here. There's a few things you said, and I think that's especially cool to maybe shortly tell people that besides a lot of understanding how you think and what we can do and how we can get better at stuff, you have this super cool last part in your book that has like 50, right? Yeah, 50. How do we call 50. Them? Like 50 small tips, small things to just start changing your day and even your life. And some of them sound... It's the same kind of fun thing. Some of them sound so easy, you might even think like, really, is that going to change my life? And then you say, and that's the other part here, do it for 30 days. And there's this super cool overview you have in which you can answer yourself if it really works. Like, is it worth it? Am I sticking to it? Yes, no. And then I think that's, I always like these parts, especially in books where you have went through all the text and then you're like, yes, and now I can start actually.
I found it.
Yeah, I got the picture. Yeah.
It's kind of hard to see right now.
That's it. And you have, which because it also says here, Los Gates.
Los Gates.
Los Gates. Los. It's good slows.
It's funny actually, because I got there was like one review. I don't know where it was. It was somewhere where people can respond to other reviews. I think it maybe have been on Facebook, and there was something like somebody said, you know, the stuff that the tips that he gives are too simple. They're just obvious. Who doesn't know this? And then somebody else responded with, "But did you do it though? Did you actually do it?" And the person was like, good point. You know,
yeah.
It's funny. Like, yeah, of course some things are simple. Like, everybody understands that. Just eat more vegetables. Like, everything is simple. Like, you want to quit smoking? Yeah. Stop putting cigarettes in your mouth. Like, everything is simple, but do you actually do it? That's the question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and not all of them. I mean, you have a part on natural sitting positions, for instance, like sit more, you know. So it's not all just that... he's not putting in and out a matchbox. There's still something to it, like a cold shower. I mean, I tell a lot of people to do that, and I've seen over the years how many people struggle with those very small things. But that's exactly what it's about: getting started, just doing it. I think the low fruit.
That's actually a very good point that I will add to that, that the matchbox example is just the simplest, stupidest example that I have. But there are also things that have benefit stacks. Like, for example, a cold shower has, like, we could do an entire like 1 hour podcast about the benefits of a 2 minute cold shower. And all you have to do, you don't even have to understand them or know them. You just have to do the 2 minute cold shower. And the same thing goes for sitting in a squat position while you work. Or just learning to get back into a squat position, or walking barefoot. These things are so ridiculously simple. And I've looked for things in this book that are this one thing that you change. It's extremely simple, but the compound benefits of doing it over time keep increasing, and it works on all levels. And I think those are the things that are best to start at, because, like, just learning to sit in a squat to me has fixed my shoulder problem that I didn't even know could be fixed by sitting in a squat. Like, it improved my focus, it improved my running gait. Like, I can actually, walk stairs now without hurting my knee, which I used to always do. And it's really about those compound benefits, I think.
Yeah. And that's cool, because they also stay relevant. That's the funny thing, huh? A squat is still, I think, I kind of stole that from you. You had this thing first, like when you go fly, a few hacks, like how do you stay fit while flying in a plane? And it's like, I just read this 4-7-8 breathing protocol in your book. And I'm like, damn, I still use a lot of those things also. So often, and even for 1 or 2 minutes, and in the most, it's not like you get better at things, you get better at breathing or at the science, and you stop using these super small tools. It's actually these super small tools that are really relevant. A 5 minute meditation is super relevant to stick to, and it's all in the book. It's super dope. We can decide later which question was the best one, and we'll send the book to.
Yes.
Or do you want to do that now?
No. We'll give some books away later.
All right. I got one more question. Mine. When is our Hand Pen Duo album coming out?
A whole album. That's a lot of work.
It is.
It's a good question. Well, I you don't have a hand pen yet. So I have a hand pen for sale, well, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, we should definitely do some breathing and music collaborations.
Yeah.
When the travel ban or the whole quarantine lifts, I'll make my way to Cologne soon enough, because I now have a mother-in-law there. So
in Cologne?
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful.
So, well, we can meet up.
That makes it very easy. I'll have a hand pen by then.
All right, you make it happen.
I'll make
you it be happen. The hand pen man.
The hand pen man. I will. I'll buy two, so you can even travel light.
Boom.
How about that? Thank you so much for your time, sir. I we could talk about a million more things, but
me on Instagram is the most important message of the day.
I think that's the most important message. So
and
maybe
buy my book.
At the end, like, but for real, this one we can order on your website.
On Amazon, actually. Well, the German version is on Amazon.de.
Yes.
And everywhere where Germans buy books.
Yeah. I don't know where they buy books. Meiersche, I think. Meiersche is a big bookstore. That's why they buy most of the books. Is it in Meiersche?
I think so. I think the publisher has it everywhere.
Yeah, okay, that's good. I'm gonna check and I'll make a picture if I find it at my show. We find you on Instagram at Casper's Focus.
Yes.
Twitter, your Casper's Focus.
I don't have any Twitter. No, just do Instagram.
Isn't there like a Twitter link in your book?
Yeah, but that's not live anymore. Oh, is it still in there? Okay. Yeah. I'm going to talk to my editor.
Twitter at Casper's Focus.
Oh, yeah.
I can scrap it out of this book.
Yeah.
And just be like...
That helps.
And for those who want to... when this whole ban is over, see what you do live. How do we get to that?
So I do mainly like really in-depth events. So I have a 3-day biohacking breathwork retreat in the east of the Netherlands, which is for a lot of Germans good driving distance. 3-day retreat. We go basically into all of this physiology, understanding biohacking, understanding how every breath influences your state. And for the coaches and breathing specialists or nerds out there, I have a breathwork masterclass, which is 5-day, extremely immersive. We do like dissecting lungs, like trying all kinds of different breathing techniques. We do microdosing psilocybin, and it's a grand exploration of human physiology through breathing. So those are kind of my best, most open events that are also in English, and really very cool international crowd that always comes to those. So that's where to meet me.
Okay, and we can find that on your website and on Instagram probably, right?
Yes.
I mean, whenever you do that. Okay. So everyone who's neugierig,
schaut vorbei
by Kasper. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like shout out.
Shout out, okay.
Yeah, shout out, shout for bye. Nee. Thank you so much once again for your time.
Yes, absolute pleasure. It was great.
And until the handpan ban.
Until the handpan band.
Ban band.
The end of the end of the travel ban is the start of the handpan man band. We got to do some rapping in there too. All right, peace out.